Moreover, the television screen itself has a strong bias toward a psychology of secularism. The screen is so saturated with our memories of profane events, so deeply associated with the commercial and entertainment worlds, that it is difficult for it to be recreated as a frame for sacred events. Among other things, the viewer is at all times aware that a flick of the switch will produce a different and secular event on the screen, a hockey game, a commercial, a cartoon. Not only that, but both prior to and immediately following most religious programs, there are commercials, promos for popular shows, and a variety of other secular images and discourses, so that the main message of the screen itself is a continual promise of entertainment. Both the history and the ever-present possibilities of the television screen work against the idea that introspection or spiritual transcendence is desirable in its presence. The television screen wants you to remember that its imagery is always available for your amusement and pleasure. The television preachers themselves are well aware of this. They know that their programs do not represent a discontinuity in commercial broadcasting, but are merely part of an unbroken continuum. Indeed, many of these programs are presented at times other than traditional Sunday hours. Some of the more popular preachers are quite willing to go head-to-head with secular programs because they believe they can put on a more appealing show. Incidentally, the money to do this is no problem. Contributions to these shows run into the millions. It has been estimated that the total revenue of the Electric Church exceeds $500 million a year. I mention this only to indicate why it is possible for these preachers to match the high production costs of any strictly commercial program, and match them they do. Most of the religious shows feature sparkling fountains, floral displays, choral groups, and elaborate sets. All of them take as their model for staging some well-known commercial program. Jim Baker, for example, uses the Merv Griffin Show as his guide. More than occasionally, programs are done on location in exotic locales with attractive and unfamiliar vistas. In addition, exceedingly handsome people are usually in view, both on the stage and in the audience. Robert Schuller is particularly partial to celebrities, especially movie actors like Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and Cliff Robertson, who have declared their allegiance to him. Not only does Schuller have celebrities on his show, but his advertisements use their presence to attract an audience. Indeed, I think it is fair to say that attracting an audience is the main goal of these programs, just as it is for the A-Team and Dallas. To achieve this goal, the most modern methods of marketing and promotion are abundantly used, such as offering free pamphlets, Bibles, and gifts, and in Jerry Falwell's case, two free Jesus First pins. The preachers are forthright about how they control the content of their preaching to maximize their ratings. You shall wait a very long time indeed if you wish to hear an electronic preacher refer to the difficulties a rich man will have in gaining access to heaven. The executive director of the National Religious Broadcasters Association sums up what he calls the unwritten law of all television preachers. You can get your share of the audience only by offering people something they want. You will note, I am sure, that this is an unusual religious credo. There is no great religious leader, from the Buddha to Moses to Jesus to Muhammad to Luther, who offered people what they want, only what they need. But television is not well suited to offering people what they need. It is user-friendly. It is too easy to turn off. It is at its most alluring when it speaks the language of dynamic visual imagery. It does not accommodate complex language or stringent demands. As a consequence, what is preached on television is not anything like the Sermon on the Mount. Religious programs are filled with good cheer. They celebrate affluence. Their featured players become celebrities. Though their messages are trivial, the shows have high ratings. Or rather, because their messages are trivial, the shows have high ratings. I believe I am not mistaken in saying that Christianity is a demanding and serious religion. When it is delivered as easy and amusing, it is another kind of religion altogether. There are, of course, counter-arguments to the claim that television degrades religion. Among them is that spectacle is hardly a stranger to religion. If one puts aside the Quakers and a few other austere sects, every religion tries to make itself appealing through art, music, icons, and awe-inspiring ritual. The aesthetic dimension to religion is the source of its attraction to many people. This is especially true of Roman Catholicism and Judaism, which supply their congregants with haunting chants, magnificent robes and shawls, magical hats, wafers and wine, stained glass windows, and the mysterious cadences of ancient languages. The difference between these accoutrements of religion and the floral displays, fountains, and elaborate sets we see on television is that the former are not, in fact, accoutrements, but integral parts of the history and doctrines of the religion itself. They require congregants to respond to them with suitable reverence. A Jew does not cover his head at prayer because a skull cap looks good on television. A Catholic does not light a votive candle to improve the look of the altar. Rabbis, priests, and Presbyterian ministers do not, in the midst of a service, take testimony from movie stars to find out why they are religious people. The spectacle we find in true religions has as its purpose enchantment, not entertainment. The distinction is critical. By endowing things with magic, enchantment is the means through which we may gain access to sacredness. Entertainment is the means through which we distance ourselves from it. The reply to this is that most of the religion available to us on television is fundamentalist, which explicitly disdains ritual and theology in favor of direct communication with the Bible itself, that is, with God. Without ensnaring myself in a theological argument for which I am unprepared, I think it both fair and obvious to say that on television, God is a vague and subordinate character. Though his name is invoked repeatedly, the concreteness and persistence of the image of the preacher carries the clear message that it is he, not a he, who must be worshipped. I do not mean to imply that the preacher wishes it to be so, only that the power of a close-up televised face in color makes idolatry a continual hazard. Television is, after all, a form of graven imagery far more alluring than a golden calf. I suspect, though I have no external evidence of it, that Catholic objections to Bishop Fulton Sheen's theatrical performances on television of several years back sprang from the impression that viewers were misdirecting their devotions away from God and toward Bishop Sheen, whose piercing eyes, awesome cape, and stately tones were as close a resemblance to a deity as charisma allows. Television's strongest point is that it brings personalities into our hearts, not abstractions into our heads. That is why CBS's programs about the universe were called Walter Cronkite's Universe. One would think that the grandeur of the universe needs no assistance from Walter Cronkite. One would think wrong. CBS knows that Walter Cronkite plays better on television than the Milky Way, and Jimmy Swaggart plays better than God. For God exists only in our minds, whereas Swaggart is there to be seen, admired, adored, which is why he is the star of the show, and why Billy Graham is a celebrity, and why Oral Roberts has his own university, and why Robert Schuller has a crystal cathedral all to himself. If I am not mistaken, the word for this is blasphemy. There is a final argument that whatever criticisms may be made of televised religion, there remains the inescapable fact that it attracts viewers by the millions. This would appear to be the meaning of the statements quoted earlier by Billy Graham and Pat Robertson that there is a need for it among the multitude, to which the best reply I know was made by Hannah Arendt, who, in reflecting on the products of mass culture, wrote, "This state of affairs, which indeed is equaled nowhere else in the world, can properly be called mass culture. Its promoters are neither the masses nor their entertainers, but are those who try to entertain the masses with what once was an authentic object of culture, or to persuade them that Hamlet can be as entertaining as My Fair Lady and educational as well. The danger of mass education is precisely that it may become very entertaining indeed. There are many great authors of the past who have survived centuries of oblivion and neglect, but it is still an open question whether they will be able to survive an entertaining version of what they have to say." If we substitute the word religion for Hamlet and the phrase great religious traditions for great authors of the past, this quotation may stand as the decisive critique of televised religion. There is no doubt, in other words, that religion can be made entertaining. The question is, by doing so, do we destroy it as an authentic object of culture? And does the popularity of a religion that employs the full resources of vaudeville drive more traditional religious conceptions into manic and trivial displays? I have already referred to Cardinal O'Connor's embarrassing attempts to be well-liked and amusing, and to a parish priest who cheerfully tries to add rock music to Catholic education. I know of one rabbi who has seriously proposed to his congregation that Luciano Pavarotti be engaged to sing Kol Nidre at a Yom Kippur service. He believes that the event would fill the synagogue as never before. Who can doubt it? But as Hannah Arendt would say, that is the problem, not a solution to one. As a member of the Commission on Theology, Education, and the Electronic Media of the National Council of the Churches of Christ, I am aware of the deep concern among established Protestant religions about the tendency toward refashioning Protestant services so that they are more televisable. It is well understood at the National Council that the danger is not that religion has become the content of television shows, but that television shows may become the content of religion.